today I'm in Wetherby with Adam Norman. Thanks very much, Adam, for agreeing to talk to us today. So you're a professional punter.
Yeah, it's. I think it's not a term that any of us are particularly happy to sort of be labelled with, but I guess that's the top and bottom of it, you know. I mean, if people are saying, what do you do? And you say you're a pro punter or pro gambler, it's like, you know, the response is, oh, that's interesting, or, you know, that you get a funny look and people immediately think you're dodgy or flash or, you know, something like that. But yeah, you know, without the punting, I wouldn't exist. So there are one or two other things I do, but it all stems from the work that I put in, you know, for the betting, basically. Yeah.
Okay, so how do you operate? What's your edge, if you don't mind telling us all?
Well, I always enjoyed going racing. I mean, that's basically the backstory. Dad took me when I was 7 to Market Race, and that was the first ever time I went racing, and just completely got hooked. I guess it all just sort of developed from there. I went racing as much as I could, and I just found that punting at the track was easier than punting just watching TV, you know. And Dad always, well, we always arrived about an hour and a half before the first, so we were always the first in the paddock and watching them going around 10 times before the first race. So I always had a good idea of what I wanted to bet purely through looking at them in the paddock. And I don't know how I've got that sort of, I don't know if it's an ability, but just that sort of feel for how they look. And just sort of developed from there, really. I just it's not an obsession, but I just always just loved going racing, got the buzz out of going racing. And I always sort of wanted to, you know, be in racing and just be around horses and that sort of thing, really.
So you must be one of the few professional punters, in inverted commas, if you like, that still actually ply their trade at the race course.
Yeah.
Now, you say you take a big slice of information out of the paddock. For the layman amongst us, myself included, what is it you're looking for?
I think it's a very subjective thing. So there's two or three of you watching the paddock, and you can come out with a totally different conclusion to the guy next to you. It's a very subjective thing. I don't just go racing with a blank canvas. You know, obviously I do all the study that I can do. I always say that the paddock is the final piece of the jigsaw, and you're looking for well-being, confirmation, just general health, skin, how they look in the skin, whether they're carrying condition, just general well-being, and you just bake it into the pie of everything else that you've studied on the race. Yeah, I think I don't really get an edge on the flat. I just do the jumps. I've never been really into the flat that much for some reason. I don't really find an edge on the flat. All shapes and sizes seem to perform, you know, to whatever they're capable of. Whereas the jumps, I can just see something that's going to evolve into something better. And it's just nice to be a professional that I can get to the races often enough. I can see a horse develop over 6 or 7 runs in a season, and I can see that development from October or November time to right through to the spring, and you can just see that a horse is ready to produce a personal best just through its either growth or its strengthening or just its condition or lack of condition. Obviously they can go the other way, so I think that's what I enjoy most, seeing a horse progress, you know, from a young age to old age, basically.
So is it all in your head, or do you take photographs, make notes?
No, I don't take photographs. I try and rely on my brain. I have a hard copy that I write down notes every race. And then when I get back, I will transfer that to Racing Post notes, and I'll put it all in the blog, Norm's notebook, which is as unpopular as it always was. but it's, you know, I put it out there, and I don't really refer to the blog at all, really. It's all in my sort of my hard notes and then the notes I write. But sometimes I do go back. I have to go back to the blog and see what I write, because the blog is, it's very instant, and it's kind of quite raw. I'll literally come back out of the car straight up there and just write, bash it all out while it's still fresh in my mind, you know.
So do you ever go to the races with a bet in mind, and then maybe even end up laying the horse because of how it looks? Do you get involved with laying?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, instinctively, I'm a punter. It all started through punting. Betfair came along and sort of changed everything. But prior to that, I was always I used the spreads a lot. And actually, just looking through my old bets from years ago that I've still got copies of, did a lot of laying and sort of selling on the spreads, all sorts of things. I mean, Racing Post favourites, jockeys indexes, distances, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. It was a real, you know, the spreads were a real sort of eye opener in the sort of late 90s. I don't really do so much of that now. I don't really know why. I just find that betting, finding winners is more appealing. Do I go with an idea of who to bet? It depends on the season, the time of the season. It sort of ebbs and flows. I think 50% of it is reconnaissance, really, for future reference. Certainly in the first part of the season, I've got to keep an open mind on whether something's going to be fit or not. Something might be 12-1 in the morning that looks a massive price, but if I get to the track and it's 7-1 and it's not fit, or if it's fit, then I've got a whole new thing to sort of build into the race. So I don't do much betting in the morning, or certainly not the night before. I think that's crazy. I don't want to mark the cards of firms, you know, who just let me have fives and tens on. I think that's sort of crazy, really. So getting on isn't a massive issue, because I most of my punting, 80% I'd say, happens on the show. So I try and go generally with a blank canvas. I've done all the research as much as I can. The decisions will be made in the last sort of 3 or 4 minutes once I've seen the paddock, watched them go down, and I've got all the pieces of the jigsaw together, you know.
So how important is a price to you? I mean, if you see a horse that looks extremely fit, and you've worked out that it's got an excellent chance in the conditions today, is there a point where you will not back it because it's too short?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, value is important, but price isn't everything, I don't think. And it's certainly not for me, because I rely so much on the paddock that, as I say, and I've written a blog about it, that something could be 7 or 8-1 in the morning, it's backed into sort of 5s, 9-2, whatever. I'm not going to not back it at 9-2 just because it was 8-1, you know. I want to back it. It's interesting to me. Does it stand out in the paddock? Am I happy with its condition? Yes. Am I happy to back it at? There's obviously a point where I'm going to say that's too short. Obviously, you know. But you've got to take what's presented to you, you know. And I'd rather back a 9-2 winner than a horse than backing it at 8-1 in the morning and getting to the track, and it's not. Doesn't look how I want it to look, or something else in the race has opened my eyes and changed my view on the race. So I've got to be open-minded towards that, you know.
So do you bet with the racehorse bookies?
I want to and ought to a lot more. The ring obviously isn't what it used to be, and it used to be, I think that was one of the sort of intoxicating parts of learning to love the game is that you went from the paddock to the betting ring, and it was a jungle, you know. And you could almost sense, not intuition, but you can almost sense there was a market move was coming, and getting the price was almost part of the fun, really. But I'm so sort of busy with the paddock and the sort of business that I do prior to the race, that it's easier to just click the buttons on the phone, you know. But I sort of want to get away from that and get back to betting with bookmakers, you know, because they will pretty much take anything, you know. I think liquidity is important to them, you know, and I do enjoy betting with the bookies, but it's just ease, really, that it's so easy to just press those buttons on Betfair, you know, that I tend to do that more, but I do still take a load, a bundle of cash and use it if needed, you know. There is value. I mean, there could be something at 4.2 on the machine, and it's 10-3 or 3-1, you know, which is, you know, there's plenty of value on the track, regardless of what people think.
Do you ever go racing and not bet?
Not too often. Again, it depends on the season. You know, October, November, I tend to sort of tiptoe through, and there are days when it just looks horrendous, and I'm just going to take notes. But I do get dragged into bets, and it's funny. You know, you drive to Carlisle and back in a day, and ultimately it is a day at the races, and the natural instinct is to have a bet. You know, you're there to you're calling yourself a professional gambler. You're sort of there. You're looking. You're always looking for a bet. But sometimes they just don't present themselves, and sometimes you're just not up for it, or you just the mood's not right, the racing's not right, the weather's not right, whatever. And it's far better just to take notes, and you know, you don't know what you're going to see. Sometimes I look at a card and think, what am I doing here? And then, you know, 9 months later, you'll look at a note from that meeting and you'll realise that it was worthwhile going, you know.
So, well, how are the X's going racing?
I don't really think about it too much. What I do is from the blog, I sort of started a business from people that were interested in that. I wanted to sort of get out there that there is an edge at the paddock, and it can be used as part of your sort of punting strategy. And so I've got a few clients that I send the text messages to just prior to the off. And that sort of covers all the X's and a bit more, really, you know. So I don't really worry about it too much. I mean, go racing in Yorkshire, you do a badge where you know, you can get into every track. It's brilliant value. You get into every track for a year, and it's great value. So I tend not to worry too much about that sort of thing.
Okay, Adam. Now, you're actually a bit of a poacher turned gamekeeper, the other way around, gamekeeper turned poacher, aren't you? You used to work for bookies on course.
Yeah, So it started. I just wanted to get into racing so badly, and I was rubbish at school. I just wanted to play sport, cricket, football, everything. Go racing, ride. You know, so I rode ponies from the age of about 5 or 6. I can't even remember when it started, but you know, and I was always being told off by the teachers for sort of riding with my elbows out, so I was always riding a finish rather than sort of Gymkhana style, you know. So we were going racing along with my dad, and I finished school, and sort of there was loads of sort of dead years where I didn't really do much, and somehow I ended up hooking up with a silver ring bookmaker called Mike Lester, who was a brickie essentially, and I don't know. I think in the 80s there was a building boom, And there seemed to be a bunch of Leicester sort of brickies that wanted to be bookies, and they all sort of signed on the extended supplementary list or whatever. Mick was well down the numbers in most tracks. But it was, you know, I finally sort of got in there, and so our season basically started in May at Chester, the 3-day meeting, and then sort of went from there, sort of four or five days a week, going all over really. But the ring was, I mean, even then, people were saying, "Oh, the ring, the game's gone," you know, and there was like three rings, you know. We were in the silver over on the course side at Salisbury, Ludlow. We'd go everywhere, you know. And there, I mean, we were on the course side in Chester, and I go to Chester most years, and it's just it's so sad to see that in the course there's literally one bookmaker, and it's all sort of corporate now, you know. But it was you know, you do some right trade, and so I was clerking for Mick for, I don't know how long, for a few years, sort of early 90s really. And it was kind of a means to an end. It was, I don't think mum and dad were that impressed that I was sort of, you know, jumping the back of a red Mondeo every morning with leopard skin seats, you know, and off we went to the, you know, off I was for the day. But that's the way it was, and it was brilliant. And I was dying to punt, but obviously we were only making 25, 30 quid a day, so it was crazy to punt it all back. But I always felt that I wanted to prove to not just myself, but my dad, I think, probably more than anything else, that you could make money, because dad was a sort of self-styled mug punter. He knew he was a mug punter, he was a Saturday punter, and just did it for fun, you know, the doubles and trebles and the Yankee and that kind of thing that never came up, you know. And I used to sort of do that. But it was never really, it didn't really enhance my enjoyment of racing because they never came in, you know. And so I just figured, you know, if you're going to have a fiver on it on doubles and trebles and Yankees and something, why, I'd much rather stick a fiver on the one horse that I fancy, you know, that I really fancy. So my theory from betting sort of evolved from that really. And I think by 95, I decided to, I think it was 95, I just basically, that was my first incarnation as a pro punter. I was still doing some sort of warehouse work, I think, one or two days. I mean, the rest of the time I was going out with Mick to the track, and the rest of the time I was just punting. You have to do the turnover. So I don't know where I got the money from, but I was sort of betting three figures at that stage already. And it was a really good experience. It was successful, but not successful enough, basically. And of course, in those days, most of it was credit based. So I had half a dozen credit accounts. And we all know how that ends, you know. but fortunately, that led into sort of desperate straits where I had to get a job, and I got a job at SIS in the text room, where it seems like everybody else started out. And I was there for a couple of years and sort of rebuilding, you know, fivers, tenners, trying to rebuild the sort of tank. And I was still doing stuff for Mick on the big days like Royal Ascot. I'd be sort of on the radios or on the stall. And I think we'd do the King George at Kempton as well, Boxing Day, that sort of thing, just to keep my eye on, sort of thing. So I sort of learned more doing the on-course stuff than I ever sort of would really, but, you know, learning the figures and the percentages and all that sort of thing. And that still holds me in pretty good stead now, to be honest, because I do try and make my own tissue on the handicap chases that I'm going to cover at the track. So it's still a massive part of the way I look at a race. Yeah, I'll do my own tissues for at least a couple of the races. Yeah.
So when did this incarnation of pro punting start?
It's about 5 years ago. So, from SIS, I was terrible at that as well. So I kind of jumped before I was pushed, and I ended up in London without a job. Not a good idea, but it was the best time of my life, really. I was sort of doing bits and bobs. Ended up at Reading Dogs, doing some clerking down there for about a year, maybe more. And then I just got a couple of breaks and started working for Sky Text, CFAX, that kind of thing, as a freelancer. And I sort of went away from racing. I, after working in racing for 2 or 3 years, I was like, it was spoiling my enjoyment of the game. I'm sort of a passionate racing fan first and foremost. And yeah, I just got a bit. It's so all-consuming, racing, that working in it, having a job in it, you've got to do the flat, you've got to do the evenings, and it's the long days. It's just incessant sort of thing. And so I went down a different track, and got lucky, really. Pre-internet, text was still massive. CFAX was massive. I mean, as a kid, you'd run home, and the first thing you'd do would put CFAX on, check the cricket scores, the racing results, all that sort of thing. And then 3 or 4 years later, there I am, you know, at White City doing writing CFAX. I mean, it was unbelievable, really. And that's how the sort of writing started, the sort of sub-editing journalism type stuff. And that sort of went on for about 15 years, really, incredibly. And then I'd had enough by the time I was 40, I was absolutely sick of it, and I kind of thought that the end was. There'd been a lot of changes on it, you know, with the internet and that kind of thing, and I was just sort of, it was time to move on, and I still had the sort of the itch to scratch. I wanted to do the punting again. I didn't go racing for about 3 or 4 years after moving up here. I just went away from racing altogether. I think I was frustrated that, as a part-time punter, I wasn't making enough. It's a kind of a chicken and egg situation, because with a full-time job, it's very hard to put in all the work that you need to be successful enough to build the tank to start, you know, to do it professionally. But it got to the point where I just came up with a plan that I would do a blog and reach out to people and see, and just open a few doors and see where it would take me, really. But the punting had to work. So I planned to leave about a year before I left. Did the blog for 9 months, so I had loads of content to put straight up when I went live, when I left work. And so that was it, really. We just hit the ground running in, I think, 2014, something like that.
Hit the ground running. That's quite a leap of faith to go from a job to pro punting.
Yeah, it was massive. Yeah. I mean, you need the support. You need the cash behind you. You need the support of your wife, you know, your loved ones.
What did your wife say when you said you were going to go pro punting?
Well, she knew I was so unhappy. I was desperately unhappy what I was doing. It was obvious to everybody, I think. And, you know, our daughter was quite young, and I was coming home from work at sort of 1 o'clock in the morning, after covering the boxing or something, and it was brutal, and I just couldn't do it anymore, sort of thing. So I had options. I thought of other things that I wanted to do, but I just thought, I've got so much experience, so many hours of doing this and experiencing the emotions and the trials and tribulations of punting seriously. I can't throw that away. I've got to work at that, give it a chance. And as I say, the 9 months that the season prior to quitting, I just went out punting, and just wondered if it was all still there, and it was. And she was okay with it, and as I say, you know, I just wanted to push on the door, really, and see what was out there, because I'd been working for Sky for 15 years, and I didn't really know what the environment that was out there, you know. So
did it start off well from the beginning?
Yeah, it was just solid, you know. I mean, I've always been a sort of two step forward, one step back kind of punter. I always tend to bet fairly level stakes, singles, so that there weren't too many troughs and not too many hills. It was just pretty steady away. So I just kept it pretty solid, and it was okay. It was fine. It was very hard work. Coming home, doing the blog, I would write an email preview for the next day for the clients that I picked up, and off we'd go again, sort of thing. It was really, really, really busy. That was the main problem, getting all the research in before I went to the track.
Is the fact that you can spot the blatantly unfit horses, is that a good way of cutting down your losing runs?
Good question, actually. No, probably. Because whatever sort of method you use, you just can't avoid doing it wrong for periods of time. Losing runs, I mean, there are different types of losing run, I think. There's the types where you're just doing everything wrong. And there are the losing ones where you're doing stuff right, but you're just having a terrible run of bad luck for whatever reason, you know. And I just think, you know, I can still... It's amazing. You can still see unfit horses, but play them wrong. You could lay it for a place, and it'll trot into third, you know. Or you could say, well, if that's not fit, I'll back that, and then the thing you back comes whatever, on place or second, and the thing that's the favourite that doesn't look great is out the back, you know. And you should, oh, I should have laid that sort of thing. So you still, your decision making has still got to be absolutely spot on, you know.
So what do you do when that happens? What is your tactic for getting out of the rut, so to speak?
Just plough on. I mean, you know, you're not going to get it back by stopping. You've got to plough on. It depends on if you've lost your shape, if you've lost your discipline, or if you're laying too many horses, or you've gone too safe, or you've gone too aggressive. You know, you've got to. It is a real fine line. The mental stability side of things is the key thing, and I think as long as you try and keep as flat line as you can mentally, I think you'll just pull through, because you've got years of experience to just get through it.
It's not the ideal job for sleeping well at night, is it, really?
I would never. It hasn't got to the stage, touch wood, where you know, I'm worrying too much about it at this stage.
Right, Adam. Now I've had the privilege of interviewing quite a few professional punters, and one thing I've learned from virtually everybody, apart from those that you see on Twitter, is that a lot of work goes in to being a professional punter. It's not, you know, 9 to 5. You'll probably be begging for it after a while. So, how much work do you put into each day's racing?
I mean, I treat it as anyone would treat their own business. You know, it is a business. I'm self-employed, and anyone who's started their own business or done their own thing knows that you could just work from dawn till dusk. You know, but you've got to work smart. I think that's the key thing. I mean, the whole thing of being professional is that you have an opportunity to be professional. So you've got to work professionally, you know. You've got to take breaks when you need to. It's the traveling is the problem for me, and so over the years I've had to evolve how much I've got to accept how much I can and can't do. If I've just done a round trip to Carlisle on a Thursday, and then I've got to get back to Catterick or Doncaster on the Friday, I feel I've got the responsibility of writing the blog. I don't have to do it, obviously. It doesn't pay me anything. I'm just putting it out there. But I want to do. There are certain boxes I want to tick. I want to get back. I want to write my notes up. Have dinner. You know, mess about with my daughter. Do prep for tomorrow. You know, and it, obviously time is running out already. It's 10 o'clock. You know, and I've got to be up at whatever 7 in case there's something I want to back. I want to be across the markets. So you know, I think that's why I sort of said, you know, I work from September or August, September preparation work, the manic months, really, from October through to March, and then it tails off. And you know, by you know, late spring, summer, I really do need a break, because it is just so full on. I used to work long hours, but I wasn't working smart. I was just sitting around a lot of the time waiting for the late darts results to come through, you know, which is tiring in itself. But now I'm doing far more work, but there just aren't enough hours in the day. So you have to specialise in what you think you're best at.
And you talk about prep for tomorrow. So what would that be?
Well, as much video as you can. One of the many reasons why I started the blog was because I felt that looking at the Racing Post website, the close-ups and the analysis were often some way off the mark from what I'd seen that day. The analysis might say if the favourite was beat, it might say it's to be assumed that he wasn't fit or something. Well, you know, I was there and it was fit. He got beaten on merit, you know. And so I just wanted to put that. I want to put that out there the favourite's no good because it was fair. That's as good as it is, sort of thing. You know, it's not. Don't think that it disappointed because it wasn't fit, sort of thing. So, sorry, I forgot your question.
Yes. What prep did you put in the night before?
Watching videos. Just going through the card. I know I've got notes on horses, but most of it's in my head. The important thing is to try and price up the two handicap chases or the novice chases without looking at odds checker, pricing up to about 105 at the most. And that gives me a massive start as to how I'm going to look at that, approach that race.
And how do you start with that? What is your anchor point for pricing the race up?
Start with the favourites, obviously. You know, what's going to be favourite, and what would I be prepared to lay it at? Basically, what am I going to think that's going to be the market price? So. You just go from there, really. And it's built around, obviously, the front three or four in the market. It's kind of second nature, really. And it surprises me how wonky my numbers are to when I go on odds check and look at the price. I think, blimey, you know, one of us is wrong, sort of thing, you know. It is frustrating. They're the times when you can't sleep because some things 4-1 you make it 9-4, and you know, I'm not going to bet it the night before, but I might try and get on at 7:30 or whatever, and literally you're just sort of thinking, is it going to still be there in the first thing in the morning, you know, or is it going to be there at the by the time I get to the track? It could be any price, you know. So they're the things that sort of make you keep you awake at night.
So am I right in thinking then that if you are only betting on horses at meetings you actually go to, that you're really concentrating on a fairly small number of horses compared to people that try to encompass it all?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that's part of specialising. When I moved up here, I used to go, when I was obviously working down south, I used to go to obviously jump on the train to Kempton, Ascot, Sandown, that kind of thing. And I didn't really follow racing in the north at all. So when I moved up here, I totally had to change tack and go racing at Catterick, you know, Sedgefield, that kind of thing. It's a totally different sort of ball game. So I sort of made it my job to know the northern-based horses as good as anybody else, or as better than anybody else, so I can just reel off in my head. I know what that horse looks like when it's at its peak. I know its form, its track, you know, what the tracks it likes, all that kind of thing. You know, I try and log that in my brain as much as you can, and specialise in certain trainers, certain tracks, certain horses, and just kind of stick to them. But that does narrow your that does narrow your betting opportunities. And as I've evolved, I watch far more racing around the whole of the UK, and because I have to, really, because you have to produce the turnover, and you can't just do that if you're just betting two handicap chases a day or a novice hurdle, so I do try and do much more now than I used to.
Okay, so how do you manage your staking?
Not easy. It's just staying in the car. I'm kind of in the comfort zone probably too much. It's not a bad thing, but I think to continue to evolve and to get bigger and stronger, I think you do need to keep pushing on the boundaries if you can, as long as you're still winning. Staking can be difficult if you're wanting to get to back something that's 10 or 12 to 1, and I'm not going to get much of a stake on if I'm trying to get it on the accounts. So I've got to accept I'm only going to get a small amount on, and then if I get to the track, if I'm going to the track that day and it's 8 to 1, then I'll just top it up, you know, if I still want to back it, sort of thing.
Right, so how big a punter would you say you are?
Well, everyone has their sort of view of where they stand. I'm certainly not a big hitter, but clearly you have to bet to a certain level. The turnover has to be there. You just have to turn it over. I think my being critical, my issue is that I probably bet too much in too low a stakes. I think I probably need to have fewer bets but bigger bets.
And do you have a betting bank that's kept totally separate?
That's very difficult. Not really, to be honest. After all these years, you kind of know what you the kind of amount that you need lying around. Really, it's not. I think that's very difficult because you've got accounts, you've got cash for the track, you've got Betfair that you need, that you're turning over all sorts of amounts. It's too hard to sort of, you know, if you're too wound up in the admin side of things, it can really mess with your head. So yeah, try not to worry too much about it.
So, apart from getting on, which most people would say, what's your biggest frustration as a punter?
Blimey, it's a hell of a question. I don't even know how to answer that, to be honest. Getting on, you know, there's all sorts of things on arguments on Twitter about getting on, but I mean, they've been going on for 20 years, Simon, you know. I mean, if you've got to find a way to, I mean, if Patrick Veitch can get on and Neil Channing can get on, and you know, you'll find a way. I think it's frustrating for guys betting in fivers and tenners that are having their accounts restricted, because I think that's just ridiculous, to be honest. That would be very frustrating, and I don't think that's right. But as I say, I don't really have that. I mean, I've got three accounts maybe that I can use now. One that's been very good to me, and they'll lay pretty much whatever I want. But I've never taken the Mickey, you know. If I've priced it up at 5 to 2 and it's 6, then I'll just have to have a bet. I'll just have 100 quid, and they'll get the message, sort of thing, and it'll be 4. You know, I'm not going to ask for 6 monkeys, you know, because it's always been like that. So you know, you've got to be fair to if you want decent sized bets, you've got to be fair to the firms as well, I think.
So what's the biggest frustration apart from getting on?
I don't think I have any, to be honest. I mean, I'm really happy with you know, my sort of working, and I'm in a pretty good place. It's been sort of 4 or 5 years, and most, I think a lot of people are sort of starting to look at me and think, "What, you're still doing it?" sort of thing, you know. And I think, well, I didn't go into it thinking that I was going to fail. I mean, every business, I think, is it 4 out of 5 businesses fail within a year? And then of those that get to 5 years, 4 out of 5 of those fail, you know. So I'm probably in a good place, but I never for one second thought it wouldn't sort of work, you know. So I keep it as simple as possible, Simon, I think, you know. Just go, ultimately, I just want to go racing. I'm just going racing, enjoying myself, punting, writing the blog, which is sort of, you know, which is I wanted to keep writing, so I'm still doing that, you know, so it's all good, really.
Okay, Adam, though, you mentioned that you've got a young family and a wife. How does that impact on your studies? I mean, you've got a race meeting the next day, and your daughter wants you to listen to her play the piano or something like that. Does it affect you much?
Well, I think balance is so, so, so important. But yeah, it can be massively frustrating, but you've got to, you know, what is the priority? Sometimes a priority is the work, but you know, you've got to keep reminding yourself that the kids are really important, and the balance, the life balance is important, keeping the missus on side. But you know, I love that side of things, and I'll always make time for that, definitely. And if it means that I'm not going to study the handicap hurdle, the 0-105 handicap hurdle tomorrow, then I can sack it off. You know, I'm happy, that's fine.
So what is relaxation and downtime for you? Is there anything you do to totally escape racing?
To be honest, at this point of my sort of life and career, I'm so focused on the racing, and I don't see it as a bad thing. You know, I'm in a good place. But equally, as I say, it's very seasonal. I don't do a great deal in the summer, and so I spend sort of June, July, August, you know, recharging, enjoying the garden, being in the garden, doing that sort of thing, playing golf, and really filling up time with the family. You know, I just think that's, I mean, it is kind of weird. I think it's not ideal for my wife and the extended family, but it is what it is. You know, they understand, and we work round it, and it's fine.
Right, this is the bit that the people don't like being asked, but give me tips for novice punters that aren't doing particularly well or would like to improve their game. How can they improve their game?
I think you've got to find a strategy that works for you, whether it's, well, it could be anything, you know, whether it's stats-based, trends-based, following certain trainers, focusing on certain races, distances, or top end, low end. I mean, I came up here and most of it's low end. I mean, if we have a 0-140, you know, it's like back page news sort of thing, you know. So most of my stuff is handicap chases between 0-105 and 0-130, because that's, you know, that's just what I do sort of thing. You know, I can price them up. I've got the backstory of the horses from when they were bumper horses, and I just feel like I've got that's my thing. If I start straying out of that, then I'm sort of on looser ground. So just find your strategy and try and stick and work at it, stick to it. And if it, the problem is you'll only know you've hit on a good strategy. I'm not talking about a system, I'm talking about strategy of working. You'll only know after several years of doing it. You know, it can be a flash in the pan. So unfortunately, there's no shortcuts. Experience is a sort of massive thing, really.
Okay, I want to cut some do's and don'ts. Give some do's and don'ts of form study. What? Any advice there?
You can cut corners. You have to cut some corners, but it's best not to, if you can help it. Watching as many videos as you can is far better than just studying the form. I mean, we're lucky these days that you can look at most races, even point to points, and you know, it's massive. But it all takes time, you know, and that just, again, it just comes back to specialising and not spreading yourself too thinly.
And how much lateral thinking do you adopt?
I'm not even sure what that means, but
how much reading between the lines do you do? Yeah, do you take everything on face value, or do you think, you know, that was a drifter, so maybe?
We're talking about quite complex sort of stuff, aren't we, really? I try and approach every race as if everyone's trying, you know. If I'm too cynical, then I'm going to start skewing the way I'm thinking about all the whole game. But you have to be, experience teaches you that Let's take Sue Smith's stable, for example. They're absolutely fantastic, Sue and Harvey, but the vast majority of the horses need a run, you know, to get fit. So you've got to be aware that all the form from this winter and spring looks great come October, and they'll go off 7-2, 4-1 based on the form they've just produced. But the bottom line is they won't be fit, or they won't be ready. They might be ready to get placed or whatever. But ultimately, I'm going to put that in at 10-1, where it's going to be put in at sort of 9-2, 5. You know, because I just, you know, some trainers run to a pattern. Some horses run to a pattern, and I wouldn't want to use too much of a broad brush. You can't say they're all not fit, don't worry about it, sort of thing. You know, I need that confirmation when I see them. But ultimately, most trainers train to a pattern every year, you know. So
okay, so when the punters have done their form study, yeah, whatever method they've used, they've, yeah, come up with one. What are the do's and don'ts of actually backing horses?
Well, I mean, again, you've got to try and understand pricing. I think that is important. It's not everything, but you've got to have a point where you're prepared to say, to walk away and say, that's too short, you know. I mean, it's different for me because I'm at the track, and if something's shortened, I mean, there are times when you just think, well, that's going to win, you know, and I may bet under what I should be betting, but ultimately, if I've just got the race in front of me and I cannot see anything else winning, I'm going to back it. But you've got to have the discipline and the knowledge to know that I'm not prepared to bet this at a certain price. But what I wouldn't say is that I only bet horses at 3-1 and upwards, or I only bet horses at 5-1 and upwards because they're value. You know, they're not value. Just because it's 12-1, it's not a bit of each way value. You know, the value might be the 7-2 each way, you know, because it's in a novice hurdle, you've got a 7-2 shot, second favourite, you know, that, you know, you're getting 7-10 each way, 1.7, but in the place market, it's 1.43 or 4-2 or something. You know, the 7-2 each way could be the massive value play in the race, rather than the 12-1 each way that may hit the frame, but probably won't, you know. So don't just assume that a bigger price is value, because it certainly isn't.
We're talking about value. Quarter of the odds, 4 places, or a fifth of the odds, 5 places. These special offers seem to be popping up a lot.
Yeah.
What's the value there?
I don't immerse myself in the minutiae of that sort of thing. I don't really bet that much each way anyway. So I'll leave the math to the cleverer punters, who know that there's 1 or 2%. You know, here or there. I don't know, Simon, to be honest. It's so rare that I bet that I worry about each way betting. I'd rather bet 2 or 3 to win in a race than bet each way, to be honest. If I've got an angle where I don't like the shape of the market, I don't like the front 2 or 3, I'll probably back 2 at longer odds rather than throwing 1 dart at an each way shot.
Okay.
Have
you finished there, is it?
So
one of all the things you've learnt since you've been doing this successfully, what is one rule that you've learned that you think should be a golden rule for punters that are wanting to emulate what you do?
One golden rule.
Well, as many golden rules as you like. Is there anything that you've learned that you think this is imperative to success?
I think your mental approach is so important. It's so important, and how you maintain that level is down to the way you manage your life, really. There's definitely days where I've got to the track and I'm not there. Whether it's because I don't feel very well, the weather's terrible, I've had a bad journey. dad's just passed away. Dad passed away last winter, and that complete. I mean, you think you're on top of it, but you're sort of not really. You're not really there. You might have split up with your girlfriend or met somebody. Even worse, you know. So, you know, you could be betting with an emotion that you don't even know is sort of bubbling around there, you know. And you come back and you think, or you've had a day and you just think, what happened there, sort of thing, you know. You've really got to be across it. You can't just open Betfair and start clicking, or you've got to. You've really got to know that you're on it, and it makes a massive difference. I mean, that's probably a naff answer, but aside from the practical thing, we all have, form study, video watching, getting on, all these sort of things. We all have these issues, but I think, you know, if your mental state isn't right, then, you know, you might as well just chuck it all out, really.
Right, and finally, is this something you can see yourself doing into retirement age, or is there an exit strategy at some point?
I hope so. I think because ultimately I just adore being, I just love being around horses. I just feel totally at home when I'm at the track. It's like I'm at the office. I don't ever not want to go racing. I mean, I can have, even if in the middle of a bad run, I get to the track and I'm like, oh, this is, you know, I just feel, I'm like, oh, you know. This is it. This is, you know, I'm doing what I've always wanted to do. And yes, it's tough. And I'm, you know, and part of me is thinking, what are you doing? You know, or there's a voice going, I don't know what I'm doing today, but I'm just there in it. And, you know, touch wood, it'll just keep going, really. You know, as long as I stick to what I know I'm good at, then it will just keep going. And there may be a point where I don't want to do it anymore, or I feel that I've done it. I'll evolve into doing something else. You know, I don't just want to be defined as a punter or just be a punter. You know, there's other things that within racing that I might be capable of doing. So if it evolves into something else, then fine. But I'll always have that sort of punting gene, I think, and always want to be a punter.
Brilliant, Adam Norman. Okay. Thank you very much.